Welcome to the talk by Stuart Firestein that I've been trying to make happen for 7 years. Finally. And we're happy to say this Sigma Xi talk is also co-sponsored by the Summer Scholars Program. So in 2012, I went to a conference about the science of science communication. So studying how best to communicate science to people who deserve to know, but you have to unpack all the jargon and all the processing. And so this colloquium was sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences, and I often go to meetings myself. And you know how it is, you go to the meeting, if you take a break for lunch, you come out of the cafeteria line, and you go into the dining room, and there's a bunch of tables. There's a whole bunch of people sitting together, like they came to the conference together, so you say, well, do I want to sit with them and kind of feel like an outsider? There's a group of people sitting here, kind of quietly all, you know, eating their food, but they look more interesting. And then there was a table over here, and there was one person sitting at the table, and it was this gentleman. And I just thought to myself,
he has terrible body odor.
He looks interesting. I think I'll sit next to him. And so we struck up, you know, conversations, where are you from, what do you do, those kinds of things. And so I learned that Stuart was a neuroscientist. I looked him up later and realized just how famous a neuroscientist he is at Columbia. But about 2 weeks later, I got this book in the mail with a little handwritten note from Stuart saying, "Dear Amy, hope you like it. Give me some feedback." Stuart. And so I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, every student should read this book. Because it's called Ignorance, How It Drives Science. And so when I taught in the Summer Scholars Program for the first time, it was one of the books that I put on the reading list. This last summer, I became aware that the second book came out, Failure, Why Science is So Successful. And happily, I just asked Stuart to sign my copy. So Stuart is a Philadelphia native. So, and because of that, you pronounce his last name Firestein. Evidently, if he was a New York native, he'd be Firestein.
Yes.
So I'm in school in the guidance. After going to school here in Philly, he really didn't want to pursue higher ed, and he chased his dreams and went to the West Coast to be engaged in theater. And so, you know how it is in theater, you work all night, and there's sometimes not very much to do in the day. So he thought maybe he'd take some day classes, San Francisco State. And Hanna was interested in animal communication, so he landed in the class of Hal Markowitz, and found in him an incredible role model and mentor. And then Dr. Markowitz convinced him maybe he should take animal behavior. And then pretty soon he was a biology major and he graduated with his BA about a decade plus after most people in this room are going to graduate with their bachelor's degree. Then he came back to the East Coast and went to Yale for graduate school, and he completed his PhD around the age of 40. So the path is not linear. Some of you are in a big hurry to get all done, but I would say that a lot of what Stuart does and who he is was informed by going kind of off path, if you will, taking a non-linear path. And so as a late bloomer, he's got this TED talk that's had about 2 million views. It's really fantastic. And now that I know about his theater history, it explains why his presentation is just so captivating. Stuart is the former chair. I love being a former chair.
Yeah, the most important word you can put with chair is former.
People introduce Amy as the chair. Oh, I'm the former. I'm never going to be chair. A biology at Columbia. And his laboratory studies the vertebrate olfactory receptor neurons. He has also spent, in addition to his numerous scientific papers, he's published in Wire magazine, the Huffington Post, and Scientific American. The late bloomer that he is, he's been a fellow of the Sloan Foundation in helping them promote accessibility of science to the public. In addition to being a Sloan Fellow, he's been a Guggenheim Fellow. He was given the Ledfest Distinguished Columbia Faculty Award for Excellence in Scholarship and Teaching. And in 2011, he was elected Fellow of the AAAS, the people who publish Science Magazine. So he has always worked to advance better understanding about science, and that's where our affinities came together at that lunch table those many years ago. And of course, these two books have been read by numerous individuals, both in the academy as well as in the public for whom it was designed. Stuart tells us there's a third one in the works, and so I will turn the floor over to him. I am so glad we finally made this happen, Stuart.
Me too. Thank you. So I don't have to tell you what a great pleasure it is to be here. She just told you that, so you already know. But it is. I've never been to Swarthmore somehow or another, even though having been a Philadelphia resident. So I was quite pleased to be here, and I had a nice walk around the campus earlier. It's quite a beautiful place. So, all right. So I want to preface what I'm going to talk about today by saying, first of all, that I don't think I'm going to say anything that you don't already know. So those of you who have something better to do should take a moment and get out of here. I think that we all know essentially that that science is about what we don't know, that things fail a lot, and all the rest of that sort of thing. But I think we know those things in a kind of implicit way. And what I've found is that making these things explicit and putting them out there for re-examination is often quite enlightening. You find things out, you think about things about them, and you recognize how important they really are and that they deserve to be more than just implicitly part of what we do. So among those things, as you can see up here, is ignorance, doubt, uncertainty, and failure, which sounds pretty depressing, but I hope to, beginning with the magic of PowerPoint, turn these into what I consider to be more positive ideas and to relieve you of the more pejorative notions that often are associated with these particular words. And I do think that, I hope to show you as well, or convince you or reconvince you, that these are absolutely critical components of science, and they are precisely what makes science so successful an enterprise. So the first thing we might ask is, how successful, really? I don't think I have to convince you too much of this, but I'll mention a couple of things. So this is a picture of something called the Acheulean Hand Axe. It's the first known tool fashioned by human beings. So the earliest sort of tool making or something like that. This is a technology that lasted for about 1.2 million years. That's a while, right? But we could be a little more realistic and go to, say, the Bronze Age. So many historians of science in particular consider the Bronze Age to be sort of the beginning of technology, because bronze is not a material you can take out of the earth. You have to smelt it. It's tin and copper, I guess. So it requires some technology. And the Bronze Age lasted for about a little over 2,000 years. So that's 50 generations. So for 50 generations, people with the same brain that you and I have were born, grew up, and died in virtually the same technology. You know, today, if you go away for a couple of weeks on vacation, you're like lost, right, when you get back. You're at least an operating system or so behind. So there's a remarkable acceleration in the progress and the movement of things. And this can be seen in 50 generations, since I would say what we typically call the scientific revolution. There's some controversy about whether there was a scientific revolution, where it was, when it was, what happened before it. But basically, we sort of agree that it started with people like Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and those guys, and Newton, and so forth, around the early 17th, actually the early 1600s, the early 17th century. So we're talking about 400 or so years, a mere 10 generations. And in that period of time, we've developed these, well, many, but these particular equations I like because they're not only iconic equations, but they're also equations that for the first time showed that things that were true here on Earth, were true here in our lives, were true throughout the entire universe. These are laws that govern the entire universe. So we weren't just in some funny little bubble here on this planet, but really we were part of a cosmological sort of thing. So those ideas were, I think, important. And then, of course, there's all the obvious advances in transportation, communication, aviation. My own personal favorite is pharmacology, not because I'm a big drug taker, maybe that too, but because I was trained as a pharmacologist. So, um, So in pharmacology, there have been advances. Here's a couple of examples of that. I don't know how well you can read this in the back, so I'll read it to you. This is one night cough syrup. It has in it alcohol, cannabis, chloroform, and morphine. Thus the name One Night, I believe. So it's quite good stuff, would you say? Then there's Dr. Batty's asthma cigarettes. These were cigarettes that were good in treating various bronchial diseases. The big advance here is there's at least a warning label here. They're not recommended for children under 6. So I think you can see that things move along. All right, so what is it about this science, what is it about this particular brand of science that more or less started in the early 1600s somewhere in more or less Western Europe and is now spread kind of globally, that has worked so well? So let's think about this a little bit. This is a phrase that I picked up somewhere or another. It's apocryphal. I don't know who first said it, but that it's very difficult to find a black cat in a dark room, especially when there is no cat. And I find this to be the perfect description of science, in my opinion. My experience of science is this is what we do. We look for black cats in pretty much dark rooms. We fumble around. We bump into things. We may find the cat. There was a report of a cat in the area. Maybe reliable, maybe not. Who knows? You may find the cat. You may not. If you do find the cat, that's great. But then you just find a new dark room that this leads to find another cat. So this seems to me to be the way science really progresses. This is as opposed to what we often hear or what we're taught, which is this idea of the scientific method. I have a whole rant on the scientific method, which I'm going to try not to get into, but just a little bit of it will suffice because, it doesn't even like me. So the scientific method, I think, is a kind of a shorthand that we use to teach students about science, but I think it distorts what science really is and how it happens. So I would say this is what really happens in science, and it really happens kind of this way in the bargain. So what is the scientific method? Oh, I'll get to that. I'll come back to that in a minute. I'm sorry. So what made me think about this dichotomy between the way we teach science and the way science actually occurs was the fact that I have this dual role at Columbia where I work, both as a teacher. I teach a course, Cell and Molecular Neuroscience, and I also run a laboratory. And the laboratory is full of graduate students, postdocs, some undergraduates, and it's a great time we have in there. We sit around, we talk about experiments, we try and puzzle things out, we do experiments, we try and figure out what the data is. It's challenging, it's interesting, it's engaging, and it's exhilarating, actually. I'm thrilled to be able to have such a job. I also teach this course, Cell and Molecular Neuroscience 1, and it's also an interesting challenge, and it's a lot of work. It's very satisfying in some ways. It's not really exhilarating, I have to say. So the question is, what's the difference between these two things? What's the difference between the way we pursue science and the way we perceive science? So cellular and molecular neuroscience, for example, uses this textbook, this relatively famous textbook, called Principles of Neural Science by three well-known neuroscientists at Columbia. That's why we use it. Actually, we don't use it anymore. And it's a massive book. I mean, it's 1,414 pages. According to the Amazon shipping weight, it's 7.5 pounds. It weighs 7.5 pounds. Just to put that in some perspective, that's twice the weight of a normal adult human brain. The book is about the brain. It weighs twice what a brain weighs. So I thought, well, this can't really be, yeah, there's two of them there. So this can't really be right. Science can't just be about a pile of facts. This is not really what goes on in science, and yet this is the perception that we often give to students and to some extent to the public. I'd say science, and it comes from this sort of scientific method idea. So let me just go quickly through this and why I think the scientific method leaves so much out. So this is the typical scientific method. You observe something, come up with a hypothesis about it, you do some sort of test or experiment, new observation, you make up a new hypothesis, et cetera, and you just keep on going ad infinitum or ad nauseum, as the case may be. The problem with this is, well, the big problem with this for me is this hypothesis part here. So I get all of this, but the one thing that you really need to know something about how to do it doesn't really tell you anything. Like, have a hypothesis. Well, how do you do that? What do you look up in the book of hypotheses, you know, and pick one or two of them that look good? I mean, where does a hypothesis actually come from. About this, the scientific method has virtually no guidance to give at all. So I would say instead of the scientific method, we could think of something that I like to call the scientific process. And that includes, first of all, ignorance. I don't know something. It's a mystery, so I'd like to figure out what it is. You might have some intuition about what that is. You make some observations or experiments. They usually fail, of course. So you have a new question now about why they failed, what was going on here. So you have maybe, if you're lucky, some inspiration and a new idea. That probably fails too. So then you revise, and then you have an interim explanation of some sort, and that probably fails. And then you come up in the end, though, with a better question than you had when you started up here, which is actually quite a victory, I would say. The nice thing about this, and I think you could even expand on it, is it includes things like intuition, inspiration, revision. It includes all these ideas that we think, that I think we too often divorce from the scientific process, as if it's just this recipe, this scientific method, that there's a recipe for doing it. You put stuff in the top, you crank it around like this, and the data and the gadgets and the cures and all just fall out the bottom. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to really work that way. So I always like this quote from Marie Curie, who, and this is one in a letter to her brother after she received her second graduate degree. So she knew a lot of stuff, but in spite of that, that's not what she cared about. One never notices what has been done. One can only see what remains to be done. And I realized, I thought, that it was what the remains to be done that's so important in science and in the pursuit of science, and should be so in the teaching of it as well, I'd like to say. I always say, some of you will know this, but I always have to make this comment. It's one of my favorite pictures of Professor Curie, because I am convinced that that glow behind her is actually not a photographic effect. I think that's her glowing away, to tell you the truth. But it doesn't, I mean, you know, her papers to this day, her notebooks to this day, are stored in a basement room in the library of the Bibliothèque Française, which is a concrete and lead-lined room. And if you're a scholar and you want to go work on the notebooks, you have to wear a radiation suit because the notebooks are still that hot, as it were. And I think she knew that. And I think that's also one other ingredient in science that we often forget, which is courage. It takes a certain amount of courage to do it. This was an excessive amount of courage, perhaps, but even regular science takes a lot of courage to do. So I like this model. I didn't make this up, a number of people have said it, but there's this notion that we have a certain amount of knowledge, and let's say it's a circle or a sphere in this sort of sea of darkness, this ignorance. The thing is, as our knowledge grows, right, there's a circumference, which you know is some formula there, it's the circumference about 6 times the radius, but as our knowledge grows, so also then does that circumference grow. So also does that circumference grow, the part of it that's in touch with the ignorance. And so as knowledge grows, maybe counterintuitively, ignorance grows as well. What we don't know also grows. So I like to say knowledge is a big subject, but ignorance is actually a bigger one. Well, we don't often think that because we have these big books that we look at. There's another quote from James Clerk Maxwell, perhaps the greatest physicist between Newton and Einstein, who said that thoroughly conscious ignorance is the prelude to every real advance in science. So it's this idea of thoroughly conscious ignorance. So, of course, I'm using the word ignorance to be slightly provocative, but I don't mean it in any of the pejorative ways. I don't mean stupidity. I don't mean, you know, inattention to fact or real thing. I don't mean any of that kind of stuff. I mean this idea, rather, thoroughly conscious ignorance. It's a different kind of ignorance than just being stupid. It's a not knowing because something just isn't known. It's a mystery. It remains a mystery, and that's where we should be. So we often, I think, have this idea about education that we start by not knowing something, and then we go to school, or we read a book, or we do this or that, and we get some knowledge. And that's true. But then the big question is, what do you do with that knowledge? So I think it's a sort of a double arrow, right? It's a double-sided arrow. The purpose of knowledge is to develop what I would call better ignorance. Because, you know, ignorance, it's one word, but it really, there's low-quality ignorance and there's high-quality ignorance. There's good stuff and there's bad stuff, in my opinion. And in fact, this is what scientists mostly argue about, is the quality of the ignorance that they're interested in. I mean, sometimes these are bull sessions, and sometimes they're grant proposals. Sometimes I guess you can't tell the difference. But nonetheless, that's what we argue about, is the quality of the ignorance. And so that's really the purpose of gaining knowledge, is to pose a better question, to come up with a more sophisticated version of whatever question you started with. So in the end, the purpose of knowledge is questions. I'd like to use this as a story. This is I.I. Rabi, a famous physicist, Nobel laureate. Actually, he was at Columbia University. He won the Nobel Prize in 1944 for developing something called NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, a technique still extremely important today in chemistry laboratories. And as a medical diagnostic device, we now know it as MRI, but it's the same stuff. And so Rabi developed this, and I never knew him actually. He passed away before I got there, but I do know colleagues of his, and he used to tell this story, or so legend has it, about growing up on the Lower East Side of New York as a young, I think it's important to say today, as a young immigrant child, excuse me, and he and his friends would come home from school every day, and their mothers would ask them, you know, well, what did you learn in school today? But Mrs. Rabi would say to I.I. Rabi would say, so Izzy, Isidore, did you ask any good questions today? And I think Mrs. Rabi had the right idea. It wasn't what did you learn today, it's did you ask any good questions today? So Izzy won a Nobel Prize. I'm sure his friends did okay too. I don't know, none of them won a Nobel Prize, I can tell you that. So I think Mrs. Rabi had the right idea. It's in the questions that you really come to see what's going on. So let's say science is in the end then the search for better ignorance. Let me put this in yet a slightly different frame, using a bit of poetry, I suppose, this term negative capability, which sounds a bit like an oddball term. It was actually first coined by the dreamy-eyed poet John Keats in a letter to his brother as well. Apparently writing letters to your brother is a good idea, I don't know. Anyway, he came up with this term negative capability, which he defined as that is when a man, person, what we would say today, is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, or doubts without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So the notion here is that being in a state of ignorance, if you will, being in a state of mystery or doubt, requires patience, and you should be patient with it. You should develop this negative capability. He considered this the ideal creative state for the literary mind, but I think it's true for any mind. And so, in addition to the word courage, I would say patience is also a very important and often overlooked quality of doing science. This ability to remain comfortably in ignorance and uncertainty. Now, that doesn't mean you don't do anything about it, but you have to learn to be comfortable with not knowing somehow or another. So I think this is one very important idea. It was restated, I have to say, I don't think Schrodinger knew about it, but Erwin Schrodinger, a famous physicist, of course, who knew something about cats, right? Or didn't, as the case may be, right? So said that in an honest search for knowledge, you quite often have to abide by ignorance for an indefinite period. So it's this idea of being patient with ignorance, of being patient with doubt, uncertainty, and the unknown. And that's where creative things actually happen in science. All right, so we have the unknown. Good. What about, we go a little deeper. If you think ignorance is good, what about the stuff we don't even know we don't know, the unknown unknown, which was unfortunately made popular recently by this character, who a few of you in the room at least will know as the Secretary of Defense during the misbegotten military adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in a Senate inquiry into what went wrong over there, he made the following statement. There were some things we didn't know, you know, that is known unknowns, that is things we didn't know. But what really got us were the unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know. So this is yet a deeper level of ignorance. Fortunately, I'm here to tell you that Rumsfeld didn't make this up. He was roundly ridiculed for the statement, but it's actually a very clever statement. And he was not the first person to say it. As far as I can tell, the first person to say it was, of all people, the poet D.H. Lawrence in an epic poem called New Heaven and Earth, which I personally can't recommend to you. I think it's kind of boring, but if you like epic poems of this sort, okay. But in any case, it's a sort of a poem about the transition from this life to the afterlife, And towards the end of it, in a verse very close to the end, he says, "Now here was I, new awakened, with my hand stretching out and touching the unknown, the real unknown, the unknown unknown." So this idea of a real unknown, the unknown unknown. Well, how do you get to this really deep level of ignorance? Not just what we don't know, but what we don't even know we don't know. How could you get to that? And my suggestion is this way. That's where failure becomes very useful. Not something to avoid, not an unfortunate occurrence, but actually a portal into the deepest level of the unknown, the unknown unknown. I'll use another quote here. I have a lot of quotes sprinkled throughout this. It's not that I intend to give anything more authority by this. I just think if somebody said something smart, they shouldn't be left out just because they're dead. I mean, and also I suppose because I think it's important for us to recognize that this kind of conversation has actually been going on for quite a while, and it will hopefully continue to go on, and it's our job to get involved in it while we're here. So Benjamin Franklin, arguably America's first scientist, said, "Perhaps the history of errors, or I would take it as failures, of mankind, all things considered, is more valuable and interesting than that of their discoveries, because after all, the truth is uniform and narrow. But screwing up, there's an endless ways you can mess up, right? So obviously it's much more interesting, failures." This is also something that's called the Anna Karenina effect, because Tolstoy, the famous author, was once asked why he always writes about unhappy families. His answer was, "Well, happy families are all happy in the same way, but unhappy families, there's thousands of ways they're unhappy, so they're a lot more interesting to write about." But it is the case here. Once you know something, you know it. I mean, the truth is the truth, that's the end of it, and that's kind of the end of the story, whereas when something fails, a question opens up. So let me once again, though, try to disabuse you of the common word, the common idea of failure, the way it's most commonly used, because I don't mean any of these things here. So this is a famous one. "Success is learning to fail again and again with no lack of enthusiasm," regularly attributed to Winston Churchill, who in fact never said it. I don't know who did say it, but he did not. "Fail hard, fail fast" is a favorite of the tech industry at the moment. "I've discovered 10,000 ways that don't work." This actually was said by Thomas Edison upon inventing the light bulb, which I always find funny because we think click, light bulb, I had an idea. But actually he claimed he found 10,000 ways it didn't work first. You know WD-40, that great stuff that you spray on everything and it makes it better? So it's sort of a lubricant. It's a way of getting rid of water, actually. But the reason it's called WD-40 is that there were 39 failed versions of it before they came up with 40. So that's why it's WD-40. Failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently. This I actually got at a Chinese restaurant in a fortune cookie, so I thought I'd take a picture of it. Failure is opportunity in disguise. This was said by Gloria Swanson, a famous actress of many years ago. If you're 40 years old and never had a failure, you've been deprived. I'm not quite sure what she had in mind there, but I find it intriguing. So all of these things are useful nostrums. I mean, if you have a friend on the phone who's just failed in sport or love or something like that, sure, you say these things. But none of them are the kind of failure that I'm talking about, in the sense that the ignorance I'm trying to talk about is not just stupidity. So let's think about what failure is. I have a couple of quotes for this that I think capture it better. So much like the Keats quote about negative capability, I like this one by the always enigmatic Gertrude Stein. "A real failure does not need an excuse. It is an end in itself." I think it's a very, very important idea, not an easy one, because we're so used to thinking, oh yes, failure, that's a good thing because it teaches you perseverance, or you learn from your failures, or all sorts of, eventually good things happen from your failure. But not Gertrude Stein. She thought a failure can be an end in itself. I think it's an important idea to let mull around in your head. Similarly, this is from Samuel Beckett, no less enigmatic. "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better." So this is curious because at first it sounds like the old trope. Yeah, try, fail, no matter, try again, fail again, and then fail better. Is there a way to fail better? Is there a way to learn to fail better? Not just plain old fails. This was Samuel Beckett in a late novel of his. So I think the important idea here is that failure is not only valuable retrospectively, because eventually it led to some success or unexpected discovery or finding, sometimes called serendipity, which is yet a whole other subject we could talk about. I think it's all fine, but I don't think that's a requirement for a failure to be valuable. Failure is, I think, integral to the process of science. You can't leave it out or avoid it. You can learn to do it better. You can learn to utilize it and improve upon it. You can make it work for you. But it's integral to science. You just cannot have science without failure as well. All right, so if you've gone with me this far, which you may not have, and you can scream at me afterwards, we could ask a couple questions about failure. One would be how much failure, because it obviously can't be 100%, I don't think, right? But I do think we often underestimate, significantly underestimate, the amount of failure that's acceptable. So let me use an example here from the natural world, if you will. These guys here, these are all the kings of their various niches, right? They're the top of the food chain, their evolution's great success stories. And I suspect you mostly believe, as I did for many years, that anytime they got a little hungry or whatever, they just go out and bag a little snack, right? I mean, that's what they do. They're the king of this and they're the head of that. But in point of fact, there's a vast literature, actually, a predator-prey literature, in which you learn that these great predators are successful in fewer than 25% of their attempts. 75% of the time, they fail. They do not kill the animal and eat the animal thereafter. That's why there's so many animals left on the planet that are not predators, obviously. So they managed to be evolution's great success story with a failure rate of 75%. That's not bad, making a living at 71%. I don't think I have it here, but I often use I should have, because it's baseball season. Well, this is the obligatory New Yorker cartoon. So I don't think there's anything that makes golf more fun, frankly. That's a personal view. But it certainly would not be fun with a big hole like that, right? I mean, that's just kind of dumb to do, right? And a great deal of what we do, actually, interestingly, in athletics, for example, is we purposely make things difficult, right? Here, just get this ball into that really big net. You can't use your hands. Well, what? But somehow or another, we enjoy this idea of making something difficult enough that you'll fail most of the time. And that somehow or another works. It makes the process, it gives the process a certain actual kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? A certain kind of reliability. I mean, if everything you did always succeeded in a lab, would anybody believe you? You know, it needs to fail a bit first, then you get it right. Oh, okay, now I kind of believe you. All right, so another question we could ask is how big a failure? Because one of the things I think science, well, let me go on with how big a failure first. Let's take the worst kind of failure, right? A debacle. I mean, that really, you know, the meaning of the word debacle is an unmitigated disaster, a total failure. So let's see. But here's an interesting thing about this word. The etymology of this word is that it comes from a French word, not in such common use anymore, but it comes from the French word débâcle. And débâcle had originally a kind of a nautical meaning. It was involved in ice breaking. So, but it means to free, to unbar, or to unleash. And as I say, it had a nautical meaning in ice breaking. The idea was to break something up to make a new pathway. Well, that actually doesn't sound so bad, does it? I mean, that actually sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? So it's true that creativity, we're all involved and we're all trying to figure out what makes things creative. And everybody will tell you, well, it's associating new ideas that are not normally associated. But I think it's also true that it may come just as powerfully from dissociating ideas that have been too long associated together. In fact, this is a philosopher of the early 1900s, a Spanish philosopher, who wrote, it costs more to dissociate ideas than to associate them. And so this idea of a debacle is actually somehow or another related to the idea of a breakthrough, right? Which we now consider a great discovery, an important discovery. And so once again, I think a relatively big failure can sometimes provide a tremendous breakthrough. It opens up an area that was completely unknown or unexpected. And that, of course, can be very valuable. So one of the tricks I think that science has figured out, and it's a very valuable one, one we could use in many other areas, is how you can fail regularly and fail pretty big without it being catastrophic. Without it ending your career or ending your life or things like that. It can be a setback, that's true, but it's usually not catastrophic in science to fail. All right, so there are two key ideas that I'd like to sort of leave you with here, and then one little coda at the end about ignorance and failure. One is this notion of negative capability as being part of ignorance, the idea of being able to remain in doubt and uncertainty with patience. And the other is failure being an end in itself, and that one can fail better, that it's part of the process, an integral part of the process. Not one that you avoid or one that you make an excuse for, but a crucial part. So this leads us to the sort of, problem of certainty or the value of uncertainty. Let's see if I have, I probably have some slides out of order. So this is an issue that's important now in science, certainty and uncertainty, because, you know, if you believe in ignorance and failure, then you have to accept a fair amount of doubt and uncertainty as part of the process as well. And so sometimes we like uncertainty. There's some areas in the world and in our lives where we like uncertainty, right? Poker, roulette, sporting events. I mean, even, you know, mortality. I mean, nobody really wants to know the exact time and date of their death, I don't think, unless there's some weirdo in the room here. So for the most part, we welcome these sort of uncertain situations. We enjoy, we have spoiler alerts and all sorts of things like that, right? But I think these uncertainties have a fundamental difference with scientific uncertainties, because in some ways, at some point, all of these uncertainties will resolve. The hand will be shown, the roulette ball will drop. Somewhere in some county record will be the date and time of your death will indeed be recorded, and it will be an actual number. But if science, I think, has a much grander sort of uncertainty. Let's see. Oh, this slides are slightly out of order. This is a haiku from Basho. Too much mist, can't see Fuji. Makes it more interesting. So that kind of uncertainty can make things often more interesting. Now let's see, now I have, right. So the grander uncertainty of science, though, to me, is that there may not be an ultimate solution. There may not be any lasting resolution or a complete answer, or in a phrase that we should all be worried about, a final solution, right? Nobody really wants a final solution. I think we've learned that now, right? Because we're not looking for an end point. There may be an ultimate answer. Maybe there is an ultimate truth, but surely we are nowhere close to ultimate. So why proceed that way? Why proceed in such a way as if that's what we're after? Instead, I think we try in science to develop what I would call stable probabilities. That is, you don't have to get zero or one. You don't have to have what we call a posterior zero or one. But whatever the probability is, you want a stable. You want to get as much information as you can to come up with a kind of a stable probability, if you will. So the question is not how we become certain, but how it is we've become so damn successful being as uncertain as we often are. I mean, I think this is a very good question to ask about science and to answer about it when people say, well, but if you're not certain about this, this is one of the big issues in climate change, right? Well, you know, let me know when you're certain about it, then I'll stop driving my car, maybe, or something like that. So, but the level of uncertainty, I mean, in science, science works by being true enough, as they say. This is a quote from an engineer, George Box, that all models are wrong, but some are useful. And that's the way we proceed in science, from one slightly true thing to another slightly truer thing, as it were. But are you looking for ultimate truth? I don't think so. So let me give you an example of this. There are many ways to be wrong. There are many levels of being wrong. So it was originally thought, of course, that the Earth was at the center. That was Ptolemy. That the Earth was at the center of the planetary system, the center of the universe or whatever, and everything revolved around it. That's clearly not right. So then along comes Copernicus and Galileo, and they come up with the heliocentric view. The sun is at the center, and all the planets circle the sun. That actually is not correct either, because they don't make circles. And it took Kepler to come along, who realized that the prediction of where Mars should be was, I think, 8 minutes of arc off. 8 minutes of arc is if you stick your thumb out, it's about half your thumbnail in the sky. And Kepler spent 6 years trying to figure out how things could be wrong by 8 minutes of arc, and came to the recognition that planetary orbits are elliptical. That may not sound like much, but everything that Newton did after that could never have happened if this idea of elliptical orbits was not somehow already in place. And so this is kind of right. But if you think that this is just as wrong as this, then that's not right either, right? So this isn't right, but it's hardly as wrong as that is. And that's the important thing, is that we have these levels of being right or wrong. should also recognize that this did not happen in the nice straight line that we often teach the historical heroic narrative of these three characters or four characters figuring this all out. There are a lot of failures in the meantime. Although it's a hefty read, which I can't even say I've read the whole thing of, Kepler's treatise on this, on how he came up with elliptical orbits, is actually quite interesting because he goes through every failed idea that he had. And there were a ton of them. And so it's one of the very few scientific papers that talks about all the failed crap that happened before we got to what we're publishing here. So it's quite an interesting document for that. Right, this is just a dumb cartoon, but it's true, you know. You just got to get close enough here. That's what counts, right? So, this slide is also messed up. I tried to fix some slides up today, of course. All right, scientific progress generates these things here. But the important thing is to recognize these are sources of new questions, that unsettled science is not unsound science. The science we have is quite sound, but it may not be absolutely settled. It may just be true enough. And this is one of my favorite quotes from a historian of science who died just a year or two ago, from Princeton, Charles Colson Gillespie, who says that in science, revision is a victory. And that's a very important idea, that revision is a victory, because that's what we do pretty constantly. All right, so where do we go with this? I'm going to end up here, and then we can have a discussion. I think one of the things is we should see this as all optimistic. We should see this as a very optimistic way of making tremendous progress. Tremendous progress. Now, I know progress can be a loaded term. I mean, along with the, you know, quantum mechanics and relativity comes the atom bomb and things like that. So I understand. But in general, I think we'd all take, for the most part, the progress that we've had. And I think one of the ways to see this is an idea that was made popular by this philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, in the last century, called value pluralism. Now, Berlin was mostly a historian and a philosopher of history and a political scientist. I actually only learned about him after he died because I'm a habitual obituary reader, actually. I like biographies, but who has the time to read a biography, you know? So I read the obituaries. They're like the cliff notes of this is a favorite cartoon. Actually, Roz Chast, who's a New Yorker cartoonist, is a friend. And this is definitely what you think when you read the obituary page, right? 2 years younger than me, 3 years older, exactly my age. That's really the first thing you see. Anyway, that's how I found out about Isaiah Berlin and his ideas of pluralism. He had written a book. He'd written many things, but he wrote this very thin little book for which he's become best known, called The Hedgehog and the Fox, in which he identifies two kinds of thinking. He says, it comes from this phrase from a Greek poet, the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. And the idea is, which kind of a thinker are you? Now, in point of fact, we all think a little bit both ways, and that's what the conclusion of this was. But the trick is to keep many ideas going at once, even when they may be incommensurable with each other, even if they have opposing values. So for example, Niels Bohr, the famous quantum physicist, once said, this is a tricky one, watch this now. So he said, the opposite of a fact is a falsehood, but the opposite of a profound truth is often another profound truth. It takes you a little while to wrap your head around that. But I think it's true. I mean, I think there's an important quality of that sometimes profound truths seem to oppose each other. We don't know why. Eventually they may not. But we have to be able to keep them both running for a while until we figure out why. Charles Peirce, another philosopher, likened science to it, not like a chain, only as strong as the proverbial weakest link, but rather a cable made up of many delicate strands. But the loss of any few of them wouldn't matter to the overall strength of the cable. And that's the idea of having these many different ideas going at once. So I'm going to end with this, with a sort of a story, if you will, that I think exemplifies this. This is the story of my dog. It's actually not the story of my dog. This is my dog. It's an old Newfoundland. But the story is about the story of my dog. So the story of my dog goes like this. Young Tom in the seventh grade is given an assignment to write an essay. The next day he comes in with the essay called My Dog. He hands it in. 2 days later, the teacher comes back and says, Tom, your essay on my dog is exactly the same as your brother's. Did you copy it? And Tom says, no, ma'am, it's the same dog. Right? See, it's the same dog. Now, we all recognize that that's a ridiculous thing, right? We all laugh at that in a literary perspective, but yet we don't think that way scientifically. We don't think that there are multiple ways to describe the same thing that may not overlap or may not be commensurable with each other, but would still act as legitimate explanations. And this ability to be pluralistic in our thinking and science, I think, is crucial to being able to be ignorant, doubtful, uncertain, and fail quite regularly. So, right, it's the same dog. So let me just end with these two quotes. This is from Rita Dove, the U.S. Poet Laureate for a couple of years. "Failure is a favorite of the future," and the poet E.E. Cummings, "Always the beautiful answer, who asks a more beautiful question?" Because I think that's the key thing to do. And that's all I have to say. So I hope there'll be time for discussion, a little bit anyway, yes. So thank you very much for your attention to all this. Please have access.